Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2002, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actress. Her father, a distinguished Irish actor, told her that she'd never be a classical actress because, he said, you haven't got the equipment. Her career has proved this judgment wrong. At the Royal Shakespeare Company, she's played a huge variety of roles, culminating in her success this year as Cleopatra. She won Best Actress Awards for her performance as an alcoholic woman dying of cancer in Our Lady of Sligo at the National a few years ago. And before and in between, she's made a host of acclaimed appearances on television and in films. These achievements she views dispassionately. I'm terrified of huge challenges, she says. I'm still amazed that I managed to achieve being a classical actress. She is Sinead Cusack. It indicates a deal of backbone, Sinead, that you did that despite what your father, Cyril Cusack, said to you. Obviously, there's a feisty, bold girl in there.
There must be somewhere, because I could so easily have been undermined by my dad's judgment of me as an actress. But in fact, it spurred me on.
The quote is worse than that. I think what he said was, you know, you've got a pretty little round face, and you've got blue eyes, and you'll be jolly good on film or the television.
Indeed, that's exactly what he said.
But why were you so determined to be a classical actress?
I suppose because even then I had a feeling that that was the world I would most enjoy inhabiting. Mm. And it has proved so.
It's instinctive. I mean, and that's how you act.
Yes,
it?
And also I suppose
thing.
You see, what my dad forgot was that he was the role model. I'd seen him on stage much more, because we weren't allowed to go to the movies when we were kids. Ridiculous irony. But we weren't, and we didn't have a television till years and years later, well into my teens. So what I saw was the theatre, because we went to the theatre all the
sure.
time.
But some offspring would have been intimidated by that. I mean, with that kind of role model, he was so distinct. He was treated like royalty in Ireland, wasn't he?
He was indeed. Well, I've always thought I fell short of his. I think he had a genius, my dad.
You'd have loved him to have seen your Cleopatra, though, wouldn't you?
Well, I would, but he would have probably given me a really hard time for it, you know.
But you turned her down, apparently, Cleo, for twice, I think, before. Why? And why suddenly this year or last year did you accept?
You talk about intimidation. I was thoroughly intimidated by Cleopatra. I thought, you know, that phrase that everybody remembers from the play, a woman of infinite variety, I thought, you can't. How can you do that? How can you ever imagine or have the gall to think you can play such a woman? But you see, I think what really fascinates me about acting is peeling away the layers. So you pull away the iconography of Cleopatra down over the centuries, and you stop pulling it away, and you find yourself, or you, Sue. She's there. You know, the first line of Cleopatra, and this is the genius of Shakespeare, first line she has in the play is, "If it be love indeed, tell me how much." Now, isn't that the cry of every woman everywhere? Tell me how much you love me.
Tell me about your first record.
My first record is Fine and Mellow, sung by Billie Holiday, and I would need this to soothe me and help me on my island when I first arrived.
My man don't love me, treats me all so mean. My man, he don't love me, treats me awful mean. He's the lowest man.
Billie Holiday and Fine and Mellow. There's an innate problem with the role of Cleopatra, isn't there, Sinead? Because, you know, you've got, as you say, to be quite experienced before you can tackle her. But at the same time, she has to be devastatingly beautiful. And not a great problem for you, but I'm sure you perceived it as one, that you've got to be incredibly seductive when, you know, you're in your early 50s.
I think it's what put me off playing the role for so long. So I talked to the designer, Ez Devlin, and I said, these are my problems. I need to be confident enough to believe that I am Cleopatra, and the most they say, beautiful woman in the world. Although, of course, she wasn't. You know, I've seen on coins, I mean, she had a huge nose.
A hooter.
I mean, absolute hooter. Anyway, so I said to Ez, look, what we're going to do is you're going to come to my flat in London and I will stand in front of you stark naked and you can look at me from every angle and you can photograph me from every angle and then I want you to minimise the folds. And she built my costumes around that body. So as a result, you see a great deal of my back.
I was going to say that. You do. I mean, it isn't this kind of cliche of a kind of deep cleavage for Cleopatra, is it? It's a long, beautiful back with the kind of the dress going sort of really down to the top of you, to the other cleavage, really, isn't
That's right.
And lovely fine stringing across it.
Beautiful and also pretty transparent. So you see the shape of the woman's body. Yes. But you don't see the stretch marks.
So, again, it's that sort of sexiness of being live moving. It's very energetic. You are very kind of acrobatic.
Well, when I talked to Michael Attenborough first, who was the director of Antony and Cleo, and I said, well, I just feel that Egypt is Ireland. You know, they sing a lot, they drink a lot, they're louche, they're wild. And that Rome is England, buttoned up. Repressed. Now, this is generalisation, and I hope I'm not going to be taken to task for
it. It's quite convincing.
But it was.
You were even up for live asps, I gather, at one point.
I was. I was very keen on the live asp, and I got a four-page memo from the RSC telling me why I couldn't have the live asp. And
it's
it
against
was
health and safety.
Well, no. That would have been, I would have coped with that. They said they fall asleep, they crap, they escape.
Oh, they might kill you, I think.
Yes, they all bite.
So you got round all of that, but what about in your personal life? I mean, do you have a horror of aging, like so many of us do?
I do. You see, I love age in other people. Mm. You know, the crow's feet and the lines of women of 80.
You've said of yourself that you've got a busy face, a very Irish face.
You've said it will line significantly over the years. It already has.
Well, your husband Jeremy Irons says your beauty gets more intense as you grow older.
Gosh, does he?
So that's all right then. Tell me about your second record.
Well, this is a song called O Rosh of the Vahawalia. Sinead O'Connor is singing it. I was educated as Gaeilge, which means through Gaelic. Irish was my first language pretty well. Every Irish school child is taught this song. It's about the celebration of a woman called Grace O'Malley, who was a famous warrior woman, noble woman, at the time of Elizabeth I. And it's about her coming back across the seas to claim her rightful place in Ireland and to scatter the invaders to the four winds.
Sinead O'Connor singing something I can't pronounce. Go on.
O Rosh the Vahawalia.
Which kind of means welcome home.
It does indeed.
She's Sinead, you're Sinead. Is that right? What's the, why the difference?
Well, I was taught by teachers from the west of Ireland, and it's a softer accent, so it's Sinead. Sinead O'Connor is the Dublin pronunciation. But actually, my name is Jane.
I was just going to say, you were born plain Jane.
I was born plain Jane Mary.
Yes. So you changed it. Why
I did. I changed it when I was 11. And I think it was because I had, as I say, been educated through Gaelic. And I went on then to an English convent boarding school. And I wanted to take that Irish identity with me because I was very proud of it. So I forced all my family to call me Sinead.
But when they're angry with you, they call you Jane.
They all call me Janie.
And you wanted, you're a good Catholic girl, you wanted to be a saint, is that right?
I did, because it was a Catholic boarding school. You can imagine the sort of religious hothouse. And I used to do deals with the Lord, you know, deals about, I will remain chaste for my entire life, if you will allow me. All that sort of thing used to go on.
But you obviously wanted to be a good girl. I mean, that was the point of all of this. You were driven, and therefore, you know, there in comes that word, guilt. I presume you were riven with guilt constantly.
I think pretty well all my life, and will continue to be until the day I die, probably.
Guilt because of your failures, because you were failing to be a saint. Tell me about the failures, because they're always the interesting ones.
Well, I suppose my real fall from grace was the occasion once a year of the headmistress's feast day, and every class would perform a little sketch for the entertainment of the entire school and all the nuns and teachers. And I decided to write a little sketch about the Profumo affair. My grasp of the Profumo affair, I have to say, was minimal, because the nuns used to cut out all the titillating bits out of the Irish Independent, which is the only publication we got at school. I played Christine Keeler, my best friend played Mandy Rice Davis, my other friend played Stephen Ward, and I think we got about halfway through the sketch before the nuns understood what was going on. And then mayhem, all hell broke loose. The entire day was cancelled. My father was called back from France where he was filming, and I was to be expelled. We had to get down on our knees, mother, father and myself, to beg for reinstatement. But I was made to sleep with the seven-year-olds from that point on.
Well, that was a punishment?
Yes.
Why?
Well, it is a punishment. When you're 15 and you want to be talking about lipstick and, you know, gossiping in the dorm after lights out with your pals. And I was with the seven-year-olds.
But you'd written this thing, because you did write. You did. You were the storyteller of your siblings, weren't you?
I was, yes. They used to pay me, my brothers and sisters, to tell them a story, either in sixpences or they'd scratch my back. You know.
So if you weren't going to be a saint, you might have been a writer.
Oh, would that I could have been. I mean, in awe of writers.
Tell me about your third record.
My mother... It was a wonderful woman. She wanted us all to shine musically. So we were all put on pianistas at the age of three. I, unfortunately, didn't really cut the mustard as a musician. I have a tin ear. But all my sisters and brothers play instruments. And my sister Niamh, who's now an actress and doing extremely well, but she was a flute player. And I had to have a flute piece because it was so much a part of our family life.
Part of Debussy's Syrinx, played by William Bennett. So your mother was keen on all the children doing music. You say you had a tin ear, but it wasn't just that. You were ill as well, weren't you? You missed the lessons.
I did, yes. I had rheumatic fever when I was about, I think about 11 or 10. And I was in bed for a year.
A year?
I was, yes. Well, because both my mother's parents died of rheumatic fever, and she had had rheumatic fever and was left with a very bad heart as a result. But it was a bad time. And yes, I missed out on the piano practice. So by the time I came back, I was well behind my younger sister, which was just not on.
But you did the reading instead?
I did the reading fast. My father used to present me with reading lists every week, and he would interrogate me at the end of the week. So, you know, I couldn't sort of bluff my way through. I had to do the reading. But it meant that I did read all of Dickens when I was very young, and I suppose that's where it started, my addiction.
But as well as the music and the reading, theatre must have dominated this childhood, because, as I say, your father was treated like royalty. He was a very distinguished actor. He had his own production company. Your mother ran the business side of it. I imagine you all kind of running around backstage the whole time, drinking in the atmosphere of the theatre.
And that would be correct. And my grandparents also were actors. They were travelling players. My father started as an actor when he was 5 years old, and he used to go to a different school every week. He used to knock on the local school and say, "I'm with the actors, can I come to school?" Mm. My mother was a terrific actress, and until she married Dad, she had a very sort of flourishing career, but then was barefoot and pregnant from then on.
So it's not surprising that you ended up doing it, whatever he thought you would or wouldn't be capable of, wasn't it?
Not surprising at all.
And live theatre is continues to be what turns you on, is it, as opposed to film or television? It's just all the difference in the world, is it?
It's my heartland, really. Nothing compares with being up on that stage and what happens between an actor and an audience. It's just magical. And the thing is, when you arrive on a stage, you know within 2 minutes of being on that stage the sort of audience you've got out there. You know, whether they're going to be supportive, combative, aggressive, excited.
How do you know that?
You smell it. I don't want to sound like a lovey, but you know, you've got the nose. Mm. And that affects your performance.
You also know, of course, if it's begun badly, perhaps in those early stages, you're trying to rescue it and to change the nature of that audience, aren't you?
Of course.
But after a bit, all is lost.
All is lost and you give up. You think, ah, yes, flatliners they are tonight.
Record number four.
Well, this again, it's really about my family, and my family are terribly important to me, my siblings. My brother, Porik, who's the youngest, he was a cello player before going on to become head of planning at the National Theatre. He, I think, gave up the cello because his concert nerves got very bad, so he stopped. But he still plays. And it reminds me of my mother and of all those concerts that we used to go to, the Fesh Ciol, it was called, where Irish children, this just still happens in Ireland, where they all come and perform their pieces.
Of César Franck's sonata for cello in A major, played by Misha Majsky, with Martha Argerich on the piano. You mention your brother's concert nerves. I mean, stage fright is not something, Jeanette, that is alien to you, is it?
No, it plagues me. I remember the first week of Our Lady of Sligo in Oxford before we went into the National. And I remember standing in the wings with sweat pouring off me and my body a sort of galvanic battery of shocks, thinking, what on earth am I doing? You say to yourself constantly, you say, Sinead, it's just rock and roll. It's only a play, you know. You're not performing an operation.
Well, it is professional, life or death, isn't it, in a sense?
I suppose so.
She thought she could do this, and she is a disaster.
And you do put yourself up to be shot down, sure. Because, you know, there's the critics who can very easily, you know, destroy.
But you started all this at the Abbey Theatre. I mean, you should have been going to university. You got through, didn't you? You won a place at University College Dublin to read English, and you kind of did the dirty on your parents and got into the Abbey at the same time.
I did. So I then presented them with the fait accompli, and I said, there you are. And they said, well, if you want to be a member of the Abbey Theatre Company, you will also continue your university education. So for 3 years, I led this schizophrenic existence.
And in the end, something had to give.
Something had to give, and university gave, oddly enough.
Some argument about Paradise Lost.
Indeed it was. Paradise Lost, my mother's favourite poem, and so I really worked hard on that essay.
What kind of parts did they give you at the Abbey? I mean, was it a good apprenticeship?
Yes. Well, there was a reservation in that the plays that were being done at the Abbey at that time were not great. We were billeted at a theatre called the Queen's Theatre because the Abbey had burnt down. And then we moved into the new Abbey Theatre. And I think this is actually where it all went wrong with the Abbey. We opened the new Abbey Theatre with a play by Louis MacNeice called, appropriately enough, One for the Grave. And it was loosely based around the everyman theme, and I was playing everyman's first love. And I was supposed to symbolise all that was pure and innocent and untouched by human hand, and I had a very, very touching little scene down the front of the stage with everyman. I had to gaze out into the auditorium and say, look at that couple in the punt over there. And during rehearsal, an actor, whose name escapes me now, said to me, Sinead, don't get that line wrong. I said, what do you mean wrong? He said, oh, you know. I said, oh. And it must have lodged in my brain, because on the first night, with every glitterati in town there, the president was there, everybody, the new Abbey Theatre, I said, I can't say it on radio, I've gone there, but the spoonerism happened and the audience rose to the occasion. And I think, you know, that was the beginning of the end. 3 months later, I was out on my ear from the Abbey Theatre.
Record number five.
You can't always get what you want by the Rolling Stones. Now, the reason I want this record is because on my desert island, of course, I won't be able to get what I want. Also, I mean, the Rolling Stones are part of my growing up. They were wild and anti-establishment and everything I thought I was.
You can't always get what you want by the Rolling Stones. So, Sinead Cusack, you're 21 years old, you come to London and you do a bit of acting here and a bit of acting there, but it's really ultimately the Royal Shakespeare Company that spots the raw talent, isn't it?
I'm not sure they spotted the raw talent. I was desperate to get into the RSC, but they wouldn't let me in. But finally, by dint of, you know, furious knocking on the door, I was allowed to take over from Judy Dench in a play called London Assurance in the West End.
You must have been quite good, though, to have been asked to take over from Judy Dench, for heaven's sake.
Well, I think probably I had a quality, you know. But I had no skill and no craft, and I knew it, and I knew I needed the RSC.
And you've done a Dour Desdemona in Ludlow, I read.
Oh, one of the worst, and a joyless Juliet at the Shaw Theatre. I remember some of the reviews. I mean, they were crucifying.
So who was it at the RSC? Who said, look, this woman obviously has some talent. We can do something with this. We are going to now lend us our training.
It didn't happen like that. You see, Jeremy, my husband, was doing a play called Wild Oats, and he and Alan Howard and Norman Rodway, I knew the two very well, and they were playing the leads. And when Lisa Harrow, who was playing the female lead, she left, and so the three boyos went to the director and said, look, Sinead's been to see the show about 10 times. She'll need very little rehearsal. She knows most of the lines anyway. So I was allowed in, and by then I had become rather better.
And you stayed with them for a long time.
Years.
You? 8 years, I think.
Yeah.
And two babies, really. One during.
Two babies, yeah.
Because obviously you'd met Jeremy Irons, as you say, your husband before that. You were a bold girl, you said, all the way through. You are a bold girl. And he was a shy boy. I mean, to that extent, you could say it was a kind of attraction of opposites. Right?
Yes, well, in every way opposites, because Jeremy was very English and he was middle class, you know, been to public school and all that. And I always felt, you know, a gypsy, really.
There's a wonderful line. One of you must have let it out at some point. I mean, is it true that he is sort of wonderfully romantic, that when you first invited him in for coffee, he said...
Indeed he did. First date. It wasn't even a date. I'd been invited to a birthday party and Jeremy brought his girlfriend. And I flirted outrageously all evening. And at the end of the evening, he said, I think I should take you home, Sinead. So I thought, yes. So he dropped the girlfriend off first. And then he took me home and I said, now, would you like to come up for a cup of coffee? And he said, yes, I would like to come up for a cup of coffee, but I better warn you, if I do, I'll stay for the rest of my life. I didn't let him up for 3 months.
What about both of your careers? You know, you could argue who has achieved more, but obviously he's had the more glamorous career since. I mean, at that time, I think you were as well known as he was, but he's become internationally known, Oscar winning star of the big screen. I mean, did you choose in all of this to kind of stay home and keep the home fires burning?
No, there was an understanding twixt the two of us that there would always be a parent in place. People say, you know, she must have sacrificed so much. I didn't really have to make many sacrifices because all I ever really wanted was the theatre. And I was able to do that with my children.
You haven't sort of felt in Jeremy's shadow as he's become internationally known as well?
No, I mean, there are some galling moments where you're addressed as wife and such like. No, because I was doing what I loved. And I didn't even really notice Jeremy's meteoric rise.
And how easy has it been to ignore the, you know, the invasions of privacy? Because, of course, there have been press stories about him and so on. Which come with the territory, but inevitably.
They do come with the territory. I mean, I dislike that sort of prurient celebration of people's problems. So it upsets me for a day or so, but no more than that.
You've been married for, what, 25 years now? So
something in that region, yes.
Likely to be a record for a so-called celebrity marriage. Record number 6.
My boys, and that includes Jeremy and Sam and Max, 24 and 17, they all play guitar. And this one, all three sing. And they trot it out every Christmas and every time we're together. And I suppose they're some of the happiest moments of my life. So this is Brian Ferry singing Miss Otis Regrets.
Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. She is sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam.
Brian Ferry and Miss Otis Regrets and Memories for Your Desert Island of Your Boys. What do you do for your party piece, then, if at the end of the evening this is what they're doing?
There's such sadness in my life. My brothers and sisters used to call me the corncrake. You know, I have a terrible voice. But, yes, I trot out a Gaelic song, you know, late into the evening when I really should be put to bed or something. It's really painful.
But I do get the impression that when you're not acting, you're pretty kind of cavalier with yourself. I don't know whether the corncrake voice got anything to do with it, but you smoke, don't you?
And
you
I do.
You drink.
I do everything wrong.
Yes. Yeah, high stress levels,
yes.
All that stuff.
All that.
But then when you get a part, a new part, a kind of new regime kicks in, does it? The professional side.
Well, yes, I found a very useful way into a lot of characters is a physical discipline. And it varies. Like when I was playing Kate in The Shrew, I pumped iron. When I was playing Beatrice in Much Ado, I learned ballet. And with Cleopatra, I found Pilates to find my inner core strength.
But none of these things last. They don't go on.
Well. No, but they inform, don't they? But I do a combination now of yoga and Pilates, which I just love. It makes me feel optimistic. Yes.
So that's for the island, anyway. Nice bit of yoga on the beach. When you did Our Lady of Sligo, May O'Hara, who had to be very scraggy and dying of cancer, you lost a stone and a half.
I did.
How did you do that?
Well, with great ease, oddly enough. Of course, it requires discipline because you have to cut out all those things that you love. But I did it because she was so important to me, and
but
I knew.
What weight did you go down to?
I went down, I suppose, to about 8.5, and I normally sit at about 9.6 or 9.5. And I did. I looked a bit scraggy.
You must have looked terrible because you had, again. I mean, it was sort of clothes off, really.
I'm afraid
one
that
point,
one was. You know, I managed for most of my professional life to avoid all that. You know, taking my clothes off. But when I got to this one, it was a nurse giving me a bed bath, and there was something so incredibly touching, and I was terrified. But that moment in the play during the production became the most comforting and wonderful moment of my evening's trajectory. And there was no titillation. It was about two women.
Certainly was no titillation.
No,
I mean,
no.
It was a devastating experience watching it. You obviously become very close to these characters, and I know with her you researched her for months beforehand, didn't you, and talked to cancer surgeons. So you become so close, and obviously to Cleo as well. What happens then when they come to an end, these people? You have to sort of quit them, leave them.
It's very bad. I mean, I say I'm in mourning at the moment, which sounds very grandiose and a bit silly, but I do. I miss them because they become the closest person in your life.
So at 7:30 in the evening, when you would normally be walking on stage, you feel...
I'm a bit low at the moment. It won't last. But at the moment, it's a bit sad and grim.
Number 7.
Oh, yes, this is really for my two sons. Wonderfully, my boys are starting to introduce me to music that I probably would never have come across. So this is Portishead with Glory Box.
Thank you.
Portishead with Glory Box. So, you know, these two women have gone out of your life. Where is there for a woman, I'm sorry to go on about this age thing, but where is there for an actress in her early 50s to go next?
Well, you know, I keep... Well, I've got all Chekhov, you see.
Well, what have you got there?
You've got Cardinal, Cherry Orchard and Seagull. I've got those two women still to play.
You've done all the other major Shakespeare
films. I have, pretty well.
You've done
them.
So yes. You're right. So turn to Chekhov or ask a Hare or a Stoppard.
A Hare or a Stoppard would do.
To write
something. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Well, there we are. There's the advert done. What about you on a desert island now?
You know, I was thinking about this desert island, and I look back on my life and I think, well, actually, I've met some fairly exacting challenges in my time. I also live inside my head a lot. And the yoga, of course, would calm me down. I would achieve those impossible postures. And, oh, yes, what's just happened to me recently, which is interesting, maybe this is age again, I've discovered gardening. I think I'd enjoy all that, creating woodland trails around my island.
Last record.
Pie Jesu from Fauré's Requiem. This is just such a soaring piece of music and would keep me grounded. And I think it's just beautiful and I want to have it there, that's all.
Pie Jesu from Fauré's Requiem, sung by Victoria de Los Angeles with the Paris Conservatoire Orchestra, conducted by André Cluytens. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Jeanette.
I think I'd go with the Pie Jesu.
It's the most calming, isn't it?
It is. Yes, keeps me calm on my island.
And what about your book? You've got the Bible, you've got the complete works of Shakespeare.
So. Now, I'm not sure if I'm allowed what I'm going to ask for, Sue, but I hope I'm allowed. Can I have the collected works of Chekhov?
You're not supposed to have the... You can have it instead of the Shakespeare. What about that?
Oh, no! Well, can I have the plays of Chekhov? Yes, surely the plays.
Oh, you can have two plays. Well, go on then, OK. And your luxury, go on.
Well, for my luxury, I want a very, very big hat and a lot of muslin. Is that all right?
I think so.
The muslin is keep the insects up because I have an anaphylactic reaction to... I'm dead within 20 minutes if I'm bitten by a wasp or a bee. So my time on the island might be very short indeed if I didn't have a lot of muslin to wrap around my big hat.
Oh, I think you better have it then.
I think so too.
You look like Miss Havisham.
Exactly. There. I could be... And very Chekhovian, wouldn't I look, when they rescue me? You know, swathed in muslin?
Sinead Cusack, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.